Well, hey, welcome to Crossroads, everybody. How you doing? My name is Kyle. If you've never met before, you find yourself at what has become our most popular series of the year. This is the fourth year in a row we've done this series called Spark. And Spark is different for us, and I actually think the difference is the reason why it's so popular. See, in a normal week, in a normal series, what happens is that either Brian or Chuck or sometimes me and Allie, we stand up on this stage and we teach. Teaching is a thing that's described in the Bible as being sacred, as being really important. What we try to do is to string together Bible verses to prove a point to you, to give you a principle to apply to your lives today so that you can know God more and have a better life. That's what we do. It's called teaching. Really important. Spark is totally different. Spark is based on something that is at least as important, if not more so. It's something called testimony. Testimony, think about a court of law, is when somebody just stands up and says, this has been my experience, like it or not. This is what I've experienced with God. And what you're going to hear today is from three different speakers, each of whom God has sparked and ignited something new in their life. And our hope is that by hearing them, God would spark something new in you, because we think a testimony is that powerful. Revelation 12:11 puts it this way. It says, and they overcame him, that's Satan, they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. The blood of the Lamb, the sacrifice of Jesus, and the second thing, their testimony, not teaching, testimony. There's power and testimony. That's why I'm so excited for you to hear from our speakers today. Our very first one is my friend Kim. Now, put your hand up if you've ever put your kid in kids club or middle school or high school. Anybody ever done that? I have. I have three of them there this weekend. Well, Kim has been the director of Kids Club for 14 years and the director of high school, middle school for six. So let's give Kim a hand. Every weekend, there are literally thousands and thousands of kids who are influenced and affected by her. She's an expert on kids, and she is my friend. Please welcome to the stage, Kim Botto.
I grew up loving the Beatles. And that song, All You Need Is Love, I believed it. I believed it to be true, that love is all you need. And as I grew and got more mature, I thought, what does that even mean? Love is all you need. And then there were people that I really wanted to love, and I didn't know how to love. Or there were kids that I would love, but they couldn't receive my love. Here at Crossroads, we have 5,000 to 6,000 kids a weekend. And while I deeply love these kids, some of them have challenging behaviors. And some of it's due to trauma. And you might be wondering, well, how does trauma affect a kid? Well, imagine you're driving in your car, and out of nowhere, a vehicle runs through a stop sign and almost hits you. Or maybe the car actually does hit you. So cortisol is released in your body. And what this does is this makes our heart begin to race, our palms sweat, and we are hyper-focused on one thing, and that is our protection. It's on survival. Kids who've experienced trauma have these same symptoms. Trauma affects people differently. Trauma can be a one-time event, or it can be something that happens over and over, day after day. Trauma is anything that's scary or messed up, that our brain simply can't process. So if a kid is abused or neglected, that's trauma. If a kid has to move in with grandma and grandpa because their parents have overdosed or gone to jail or simply no longer able to take care of them, that's trauma. When kids are separated from their birth parents, no matter if it happens in the hospital when they're born or years later, this is trauma. And I used to look at these kids and their challenging behaviors, and I think, what's wrong with you? You are in a safe place now. You have parents who love you. Or I'd look at the parents and I'd say, you just need to be tougher. Discipline them, train them up. And then I got to know the kids, and I realized how wrong and judgmental I was. I met a little guy, and he had a little plastic grocery bag filled with all of his treasures, which was adorable. And when he showed up to church, it was annoying because he wouldn't share anything in his bag. He wouldn't even let people look in his bag. And if kids were curious about it, he would get angry. Sometimes he'd even lash out at them physically. So one day I said to him, "Hey there, little buddy. How about you leave the bag at home next week?" So he then told me, because he'd been in numerous foster homes and sometimes had to leave quickly, he had some of his most important things left behind. And this was a smart kid. So he had come up with a plan so this would never happen again. He'd gotten that little bag, and all the things that were most important to him could fit in that little bag. And that little kid wrecked me. He wrecked me. And through him, God sparked in me a deep desire to advocate and fight for these kids. Because this little kid was not bad. He was hurt, and he was afraid, and his brain was trying to process what was going on around him. And so what his focus was protecting himself and protecting his possessions. This little boy and kids like him, they are the least of these that Jesus talks about. So what we've learned about trauma through science is that when we live in a state of chronic fear, like this little boy did, the architecture of our brain actually changes, and it changes our ability to cope and to think logically. We've also learned that the best therapeutic experiences don't happen in therapy. They happen in stable, loving relationships. Dr. Bruce Perry is a psychiatrist who has worked with thousands of kids who've experienced trauma. And he says the research on the most effective treatments to help child trauma victims might be accurately summed up this way. What works best is anything that increases the quality and number of relationships in a child's life. So, kids are harmed through relationship, but then it's through relationship that they begin to heal. And I personally know being in relationship with a kid who's experienced trauma is emotionally and physically exhausting. It's way easier to just say, you know what? There's programs and government agencies that can handle that. I'm just going to let them take care of it. But God created community and families to do that. Kids must have loving and stable relationships so they can thrive and heal. And that's why I am so thankful to be in a community here and be on a team that is passionate about reaching more of these kids and their families, a team who doesn't give up when it's hard. We have kids and students who come to Crossroads that have been kicked out at other places, and we welcome them with open arms. And it's because our teams, they want these kids and students to be able to hear about a father who will never leave, about a dad who knows them and has a great plan for their life. So those of you who are here and you're in the fight, I just want to say, well done. I love being on the team with you. You are doing great work. And I know at what cost you're doing that. And I also want you to know that God is blessing us that are in the battle, because we get to see the miracles. When a kid begins to feel safe and they open up and they start to receive our love. And God is not finished with the work that he is doing through us here. We aren't all called to do the same thing in caring for these kids. For my family, we felt called to take kids into our home 24/7. You may be feeling that nudge, but maybe not. That's okay. We can all take a step towards these kids. I recently was talking to a young woman, and a couple weeks ago, she wasn't a mom. And then she got a phone call, and she was told, "Hey, you have a relative who's not able to take their kids anymore. Can't take care of them." And this brave woman said, "I'll take them." So overnight, she went from zero to five kids. And people kept asking her, what can I do? How can I help? She'd go, I don't know. Because she was a brand new mom. She didn't have any clue what she needed. So what we can do is we can step toward her and mow her lawn and step toward her family and say, I'm going to bring dinner this week so you and your husband can take a nap or take a walk. We can also step towards other families that are hurting and struggling. And we can offer to go bike riding with their kids so they can get a break. We can be a safe, non-judgmental place for them to process the difficult feelings and experiences they have. We can commit to praying for them. And when we do, let's tell them we're praying for them with notes and texts. And every time we do this, we are taking a step towards the least of these. We are making a difference. A quote that really drives me is by Josh Shipp. And Josh spent years in foster care when he was a kid. And he says, every kid is one caring adult away from being a success story. And I have seen that. A 17-year-old recently said to me, I just need somebody to remind me who I am because I forget. So I get to sit with her in Frisch's and tell her that she is strong and that she is empathetic and that she can do hard things. And I get to remind her that she needs to clean up her social media. I get to be a part of her story. And I want more people to experience that. You know the little boy I talked about with the bag? Well, day after day, his adoptive parents told him and showed him that they weren't going anywhere. And his leaders at church, they found a safe and secure place for his treasures. And one day, he left the bag at home. And then later on, the contents of the bag, he scattered all over his house because he knew that he was safe. He knew that he had a family and a home. And this little boy, his story isn't over. Because of the experience he's had, he may always have challenges. But he now has stable relationships. So maybe the Beatles weren't that far off. We do need love. But it's the kind of love that might introduce mess into our life. It's the kind of love that might hurt us. It's also the kind of love that might grow us in ways that we never experienced. And when we step out towards the one, you can be the difference in one kid being a success story.
Music has always been my main thing. But it's hard to find the quiet space to do that with three boys at home. So I started painting last year with my kids, and I just fell in love with it. I realized in painting that I had forgotten how to just play and discover freely. Like I had grown up and traded freedom for rules. But there are no rules in art, and I love that. Painting with watercolors also requires a lot of observation, so it ends up being really meditative for me. Like I walk away from it with a quieter mind and with that childlike delight of play. To be inspired, I look to nature. I love creating pieces that might spark beauty and joy in someone else's space. God is the ultimate artist. His work is unnecessarily beautiful, extravagant, and sometimes downright bizarre. And as many things as I might question or doubt about God, his creativity is not one of them. I'm Andrea, and through painting, God has sparked in me the joy of discovery.
Cool how God uses so many different things to spark in us, isn't it? Pretty amazing. Well, our next speaker speaker I'm very excited for you to hear from. He has held, get this, the title, this is an actual thing, world champion of public speaking. That's an actual thing, and he has it. Unbelievable. About to hear from him. He's also a former airborne paratrooper and a longtime part of Crossroads. Please welcome Otis Williams.
The answer is, you've got to be committed. The question is, what does it take to change my life? Hello, Crossroads. My name is Otis Williams, and I want to tell you a story about the one word that changed my life forever. There was a time when I was totally terrified of heights. And one of my life's philosophies is whatever you don't face will stay in your face. So I decided to face and conquer this dream killer once and for all. And to defeat this enemy, I decided to do what any normal person who had a high fear of heights would do. I joined the military and I volunteered to become an airborne paratrooper. So I go to jump school, and jump school is 3 weeks long. You've got ground week, tower week, and jump week. During ground week, you do stuff on the ground. Tower week, you do stuff in the tower. And if you pass and you meet the requirement for ground week and tower week, you move on to jump week. Now, something strange and phenomenal happens at jump week. The black hats, those are the instructors at jump school, they get very nice. And so I'm wondering, why are they being so nice to us now? Because during ground week and tower week, they are the complete embodiment of evil. They are mean, they are toxic, they're trying to do everything they can legally do to get you to give up and quit. And then it dawned on me, we're getting ready to jump out of a perfectly good aircraft for our very first time. So they want the trauma, Kim, to be very low. So it's Monday morning of jump week. We find ourselves in the hangar. We're putting our parachutes on, getting geared up. Black hats are going around. They're checking. They're making sure everything's okay. And then a black hat yells. He says, "Gentlemen, make sure all the furniture is in one room." And I'm thinking to myself, why is this guy talking about furniture at a time like this? I don't understand. But anyway, we get suited up. The thumbs up come. We take off, and we're down the pathway getting ready to go on our nice journey. So our very first jump is going to be out of a C-130. We load the monster of this aircraft from the back. The back comes down. We get on. We load it. We sit on the sides of it, and we wait till everybody gets there. And then this thing wheels up. We taxi down the runway, and then before you know it, boom, we're in the air, off into the great blue yonder. So it's about 15, 20 minutes where we reach what we call jump altitude. And now jump altitude for a combat jump is 1,250 feet. So it's not a lot of time if something goes wrong for you to take corrective measures. So at this time, the doors on the C-130 open, the wind rushes in, slaps you across the face, wakes you up as if you were sleeping. And then you've got black hats, one on each side. They stick their head out of the door and they're looking for the drop zone. So they're looking, they come back in and they say, 10 minutes! So you rock as you repeat it. You go, 10 minutes, 10 minutes. That's to let everybody know this thing is about to go down. It's for real. So then they disappear out the door again. They look for the drop zone. They come back. They say, 5 minutes. What do? You rock. Let's go. 5 minutes, 5 minutes. There you go. So then they disappear one last time looking for the drop zone. They come back in. Drop zone coming up. First through the pass, stand up, hook up, shuffle to the door. So you got 10 on this side of the plane, 10 on this side of the plane. They stand up, hook up static lines, everything's ready. Then you hear this, first man stand in the door. Nobody moves. So the black hat says, first man stand in the door. Nobody moves. So then he looks directly at me. He says, son, you're the first man. Get in the door. And I'm in the door. So he's on the side of me, and then he gives me this speech. He says, you are going to be the first one out of this aircraft. You are going to set the example for the rest of these paratroopers. I need you to watch that light. When that light turns green, you will exit this aircraft. aircraft. In other words, when this plane lands, you will not be on it. Have I made myself perfectly clear? Yes, I did! So I'm watching the light, right? Boop, 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 boop. Bam, it turns green. Out the door with a nice foot in the rear to help me out. So I'm falling between 20 and 25 feet per second. So it's a nice clip. And I look up, and everything is fine until I look up, because I look up and I notice that I have what the military calls is a malfunction. In other words, my chute wasn't open. And so at that altitude, I could see the ambulance leaving and coming to where I'm supposed to land. And I'm like, that's not a good thing right there.
Right.
So I start depending on my airborne training, and I start bicycling. At that point, you can see the black hats on the ground. They're grabbing megaphones, anything they can, and they're saying, faster! And I'm thinking, dude, I'm giving her all I got, Captain. I mean, I'm bicycling as fast as I can. So I'm bicycling, and all of a sudden I start turning. This is a good thing, right? Very good. So I'm turning, and bam! All of a sudden my chute opens, and I'm like, this is awesome. Then I clearly understood what the sergeant was talking about when he said, make sure all your furniture is in one room, because mine was not. Anyway, I hit the ground really hard. Bam! The medics are there. They're checking me out, making sure everything's okay. They were absolutely amazed I didn't break anything. One of the black hats is there, and he says, son, how you doing? I'm like, I'm all right. I'm doing pretty good. He says, you feel pretty good? You feel good? Yes, sergeant, I feel great. He says, all right, gather your chute, and let's go back to the hangar and get ready for another jump today. I'm like, excuse me? Today? He was like, yes, today. I'm like, why today? And he says, because we're expecting bad weather tomorrow, and we got to get as many jumps in as we can so we can get you guys to graduate by Friday. And I'm like, oh, my God. Gather all my stuff. We back in the hangar, redoing the whole thing. Now, my second jump was absolutely flawless. It was wonderful. Total different from the other one. After I exited the aircraft, I'm descending at a nice rate. I can sip lattes, all that kind of great stuff, right? I am able to see for miles. It's a state of bliss. And in this state of bliss, I clearly heard God say to me, look up. So I look up, and then he says, can you get back in that aircraft? And the answer was no. And he said, now you know what it takes to change your life. Commitment. You see, ladies and gentlemen, here's what I believe. That the blessings that God has for you and me live on the other side of doubt and fear. And to get on the other side of doubt and fear, it takes commitment. It takes giving everything you've got, holding nothing back. It's taking all your chips, pushing them to the center of the table and saying, I'm all in. It is when your ship reaches the shore, you give the order to burn the boats and you say, either I die or I win. It is counting the cost and jumping out of the aircraft anyway. It's to get to the other side. Now, I know that level of commitment may be a little scary for some of you. But let me leave you with this, a little word of encouragement from God's word. In Philippians, in that book, God's word reminds us that we can do all things through Christ which strengthens us. So here's the command I'm leaving you with. Commit, make the jump, and go get what God has for you, and I'll see you on the other side of doubt and fear. Airborne all the way. Woo!
Unbelievable, unbelievable. Otis, I'm so glad there are crazy people like you willing to jump out of airplanes. That's awesome, fantastic. Hey, you might not know this about me, but it's probably time you did. I am a one-time T-ball all-star. It's true? True, one-time T-ball all-star. Felt pretty great about that until I met our next speaker, who is a three-time World Series champion. Yeah, with one of the lowest postseason earned run averages in the history of baseball, former San Francisco Giant and Cincinnati Red, please welcome Jeremy Affeldt. Woo!
When I put on this uniform, I drive to the ballpark every day. This just feels like I've been doing it for a long time.
Since joining the team in 2009, Jeremy Affeldt has been an integral part of the Giants' bullpen.
Got him. Oh, that's a good hook right there.
You know, I don't start, I don't throw seven innings, I don't hit homers, I don't steal bases. I got to come in for those one or two innings or one or two batters and make the best pitches possible.
Got him.
With the third lowest ERA in postseason history, Jeremy's dominance during the playoffs cannot be overlooked.
First the pitch. He struck him out swinging.
All right. Well, thanks for having me this evening. I appreciate it. This is my third experience in Cincinnati. This one looks like there's a lot more smiles than my other two. My first one was when I played here and we lost almost 100 games. There wasn't a lot of smiles around Cincinnati. My second one was in 2012. You guys were all smiles until we hurt your feelings in the NLDS and took three games straight from you. Went on to win the world championship. We got a really nice ring out of it. So I, on the behalf of the San Francisco Giants, thank you and the fans and all the athletes that tanked the series to let us go on. Appreciate that. So, allows me to come up here and talk and feel good about myself. My chest up a little bit more than it was. So, no. But 22 years of age, I made it to the major leagues. It was a great experience for me. I accomplished a dream because at 12 years of age, I was sitting in the Oakland Coliseum. It was one of my first baseball games that I ever got to see, watching the Oakland A's. And my favorite pitcher that I used to watch on TV was Dave Stewart. So he was pitching that day, and so my dad got us some really good seats, like right in the lower part of the stadium. And you're right with all the players. I mean, they look mad. I mean, all my favorite guys were there. Mark McGwire, Jose Canseco, Dave Stewart. You're just looking at all these guys, and you're looking around Connie Lansford. You're looking at all these guys. You're like, man, they are massive. Well, they're massive for a reason that we now know why. They're a little bigger than they probably should have been. they weren't drinking protein shakes, I can promise you that. But they were still big and gigantic, and it was just an awesome thing to see. And I remember looking at my dad, and I said, Dad, I'm going to play here one day. And he looked at me and goes, what? I said, I'm going to play here. I'm going to be a Major League Baseball player. He said, you're going to be a Major League Baseball player? I said, yes, sir. I said, I'm going to play on that field. And he patted me on the head like all good dads do and says, go for it, kiddo. And he didn't put me in any baseball camps. He just let me go play baseball. And then when I was 22 years of age, I walked into the Coliseum through center field where the bus dropped us off, and I got my little Nokia phone out. And you guys remember that Nokia phone, man? It had like the snake game. Like 1379, all the some of you generation, your iPhone generation. Well, my generation, our game was the worm game, and you had to chase this little dot around in a circle, and you had to do it so many times and try not to hit your tail end, you know? And all we had was 1379. We didn't draw on a screen. So it was a fun game, and you got mad, and you could actually throw that phone down, and the screen didn't break. It was sweet, right? So I got out my Nokia phone, and I said, hey, Dad. I called my dad, and he answered, and he still has a telephone. He still today has a landline. It's impressive. And I said, Dad, I said, you know where I'm at? He said, yeah, you're in Oakland. I said, yeah, you remember what happened here in Oakland? He said, what are you talking about? I said, Dad, I see the very seats we were sitting in when I was 12 years old, and I said I was going to pitch here. And tonight, Dad, I pitch in Oakland. And it hung up the phone. And I looked at my phone, and I was like, man. So I hit talk again, and my mama answered the phone. I said, Mama, I said, what happened? I was talking to Dad. He's like, he's crying. He's a military guy, man. He dropped bombs for a living. They don't cry, you know? So he didn't want to hear me. So he said, he's crying. He's just so pumped that you accomplished your dream. And he just couldn't, he didn't want you to hear him cry. And I was like, all right, well, tell him I'm here, man. And I'm excited. And that's when I kind of realized what I had done. I had accomplished a dream. In 4 years, I hated the game of baseball. I hated it. Absolutely hated Major League Baseball. Didn't want any part to do with it. It was miserable. And the problem is it's a very lonely feeling when you hate doing what you do for a living, especially Major League Baseball. Because if I'm going to go to you and I say, hey, man, what do you do? And you tell me what you do, whatever, you know, zookeeper, or Zoo York or whatever, you know, you got the shirt on. So, you know, so it is a zoo, by the way, you're right. So you know, and I said, why play Major League Baseball? And I hate it. I'm sure you would be like, dude, I totally understand the feeling. I would hate it too if I played Major League Baseball, man. It's just, it would stink so bad, man. I mean, I just don't even know why you'd even want to do that for a living. You know, like I didn't have anybody I could tell that I hated the game of baseball. And it was super scary for me too, because I was like, man, I don't have anybody I can talk to. No one's going to relate to me. And I'm kind of, I feel like alone on an island here. And I don't know who I can, I don't even know what I'm doing on this planet right now. Why am I in baseball? What am I called to do? God, why do you have me do this? Groundhog's Day. I go to the field, I get booed, I get cheered. I go to the field, get booed, and booed some more, and then I get cheered a little bit. You know, I played with Kansas City in the early 2000s. We got booed a lot. So think Cincinnati now, think that like every year, okay, right? So it was just miserable, right? Like it was just a tough deal. And I remember sitting on my counter crying. I wanted to go home, but my wife wouldn't let me quit because she's like, you know you can't quit. And you know as an athlete, you're not gonna do well if you quit. You gotta run this gauntlet, play it out. I'm here for you. And she was here for me. But I was just so frustrated with doing terrible. I got put on the DL one time for a broken fingernail. That's how it was going, okay? So it was a really bad deal. So it was just a miserable time. And I was begging God in 2006. I'm like, please trade me. Either trade me or release me, because if you release me, I'm going to take the uniform off. I'm going to go home and say I gave it my best try. I didn't quit. I said, but if you're not going to release me, God, then you got to trade me, because I got to get out of Kansas City, because it's making me miserable to be here. I hate going to work every day. And 5 minutes before the trade deadline on July 31st, 2006, I got a call from my GM. He said, I've just traded you to the Colorado Rockies. And I was like, oh, awesome. Oh, that's, okay. Oh, man. God, sorry it didn't work out. You know, Dayton, man, I just tried. It just, you know, I know what you had to do. You had to do the best for the team. And I hope you got somebody for me, blah, blah, blah. You know, and then I told my wife said, what's going on? I said, I just got traded. And she starts screaming. And I was like, hey, honey, the GM's still on the phone. Back it down a little bit, you know, and she's like, I don't care. I'm packing your bags. This is awesome. So I'm like, all right. So she's packing my bags and I go to the field and she meets me at the airport and we're flying into Colorado and I'm flying in. My wife still has to get our dog and stuff packed up. So she stayed back. And as we're landing, I realized that there's no gravity in Colorado, right? And if you understand what happens in baseball, like when it gets hit in the air, it's supposed to come down. If it doesn't, it's a homer. Well, it doesn't ever come down in Colorado, right? So you try. In fact, the first guy I faced was named Prince Fielder, and I threw this curveball, and first pitch I ever threw in Colorado, I threw a curveball, I hit it for a homer. And all I heard was, welcome to Colorado from the crowd. I mean, this was getting worse for me, right? It just was not good. And I remember I was staying in my hotel, and I got up that morning, and the mermaid was calling to me, right? I was like, ooh, I got to get a Starbucks. You know, and so I was going towards the Green Mermaid, and I was just walking down the street. Just remember how miserable I am. I'm like, I literally, first pitch I throw, I give up a homer. I don't want to, failure, it's nonstop failure. I don't want to do this. And I was just begging for a way. I could not. It's like God was keeping me in prison and laughing at me by getting me traded to Colorado at the same time, because I obviously wasn't very specific on my prayer. And so be specific when you ask him for stuff, okay? So I remember sitting there and I see this girl sitting, right, I'm at this street corner. I see this girl sitting across the street and she's kind of sitting in front of this Rite Aid and the Starbucks right next to it, right? And she's got this cup of noodles in her hand, dry cup of noodles, no water. She's just eating this cup of noodles. So I walk across the street and I kind of stop and I look down at her and she's got a split lip, black eye, torn jeans. She did not have a good night the night before, trembling. And there's a lot of street kids in Denver, right? There's a lot for what they congregate there. And I reached down and I touched her on her shoulder and she jumped away from me and I said, hey, I don't want anything from you. I just want to know if you want something to eat. And she said, yes, please. So I went into Starbucks and I got that green sludgy drink. Naked says on it. It's like, looks really bad. Tastes pretty good, right? Just looks like algae, right? So I'm like, I think I need that for sure. And then I need whatever has the most sugar. And so she handed me a blueberry muffin. Another fact, fun fact, blueberry muffins have the most sugar in Starbucks, according to the employees. So they handed me a blueberry muffin. So I walk out, hand it to the girl, and she looks up and rips the bag from me. And she looked, and she looked at me and said, thank you. And I stared down at her, and it was probably about 5 or 6 seconds. It felt like 30 minutes. And it's like we locked eyes, and it's like we connected in an amazing way. I just stared at that girl, and she wasn't saying thank you for the food. She was saying thank you for letting me know I exist. Because when we see homeless people, a lot of times we get the fake phone call, or temporarily deaf, or we randomly blind and we can't see them, or we'll go on the other side of the street because it's an awkward deal, right? Like it can be awkward. We've all been in the cities where homeless people are around, and it kind of feels weird, it feels awkward, and it doesn't feel safe. And when she said that, see, I wear nice clothes. I was living in a 5-star hotel. I went to an unbelievable office called a baseball stadium. I had a wife, I had a home. I didn't have problems with bills. I ate at nice restaurants. And I looked at that girl, and she didn't have nice clothes. She didn't have a job. She didn't have anywhere to live. Yet our realities were the same because we were both lost. We were both lonely. We were both scared, and neither of us had anyone to talk to about our current state. And I remember when she said thank you, it was thank you for letting me know I existed. And that was something I needed so bad at that moment, was to be able to be something for somebody, because I didn't feel like I was being anything for anybody. And I needed God to encourage me. And he traded me, and he put me in front of that girl that day for a reason, because it changed my life. If you flip open my baseball card, the numbers all of a sudden get really good. And I'm not saying he all of a sudden just started blessing me. I think it was always there. My talent was always there. My ability to succeed was always there. I just didn't have a reason to do it. I didn't have that desire to why I was a baseball player. What was I a baseball player for? What was I gifted to be a Major League Baseball for? Because if it was to be just a Major League Baseball player, if my giftings were just to be a professional athlete, it didn't make a whole lot of sense, because I'm not bringing a lot of impact to anybody. Except for I'm entertaining America for $12 beer, you know, which is cheap nowadays, in the baseball stadiums, and a $30 ticket and $25 parking ticket to park. And they boo me, and that's what I'm here for. That's not what I want to do. So I went to the field that day, and I felt so amazing sitting in the bullpen. I said, why do I feel good? For the first time in like 4 years, I don't feel depressed to play the game of baseball. And I went to my hotel room that night, and I did what I told myself I'd never do. I became the guy that just stuck his fingers in the Bible and just like opened it up and thought God would talk. Like, some of you had done it. Like, you know, and then you're like looking down, you know? And I've tried it multiple times. It's never really worked. But, because then you open it up and all of a sudden it's like death becomes you. And you're like, oh, that's great. You know, that's what I needed. You know, you get all these awkward verses being thrown at you, you know? And so you're like, I don't really know what that means. So I did it again because I was that desperate. And it worked. For the first time ever, it was like God knew. He's like, you know what? I'm not going to laugh at him this time. I'm actually going to help him out, right? And it was Matthew 25, no joke, where it separates the sheep and the goat when he comes back. And the guy says, well, how do I know if I'm a sheep and a goat? And he says, well, when you do the least of what you've done, whatever you do the least of these, you do to me. He's like, well, how do I know what I'm going to do? He's like, well, if you don't visit me in prison, or you don't feed me when I'm hungry, or if you don't give me something water when I'm thirsty, you didn't help me out. So you're not in. And he's like, how do I know if I did that? He goes, whatever you did it to someone who is in prison, to someone who is hungry, to someone who is naked, to someone who is in need. And if you do it for any of them, you'll do it for me. And I remember what I did for that girl. And I remember my heart was so pure when I did it for that girl. And I felt so good. It was like I fed Jesus that day and he fed me back. And he changed my life. And I finally understood Luke, where it says, you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and you love your neighbor as yourself. They are the same. And when I'm hungry, I want something to eat. When I'm thirsty, I want something to drink. And when I want to go live somewhere, I go to my house, right? And when I'm naked, I'm definitely going to want to put on clothes, unless it's Cincinnati, then it's, you're tempted, you know, to just walk around naked. It's way easier. It's a lot cooler, you know? So you get all these, you know, and I remember feeling that and just God just saying, Jeremy, this is what I want you to do. I want you to use baseball as a platform. Your success will only be the success that I want it to be if you can encourage others and show others and give others the opportunity to have success. And I said, how do I do that? Do to the least of these what they need done and give them a chance to be able to look at their dad or mom one day and say, one day I'm gonna be. Because everybody deserves the opportunity to say, one day I'm gonna be. And everybody who has ever said one day I'm gonna be, that has had some hard times come where they weren't able to achieve it, deserve a chance to still achieve it. And I started an organization called Generation Alive right after that. And it dealt with young people in poverty. And we now go into schools and we have these action teams in these public schools, public high schools. And the only reason I'm able to get into half of them is because of what I did for a living. And I go in and we start these action teams. And we basically tell kids to understand what poverty looks like in your community. What does poverty look like? What are the pains that poverty causes? And how can we alleviate those pains through acts of compassion? And it's not feeling bad for the person, it's actually putting it to action. So you don't look at someone that's struggling and being, man, that sucks, keep walking. Or too bad for them. Or use the religious jargon, right? I'll pray for you. Because I'm gonna tell you right now, most people won't do it. Yeah, I'll pray for you. Uh-huh, okay, I'll come back next week and I'll ask what your prayer was. Because we don't really know what to say, right? Compassion is actually doing it. When Jesus hung on the cross, he created an act of compassion. When he fed 5,000 people, there were acts of compassion. So I started an organization that did that, and in the last 5 years, we've fed over 2.5 million people. And kids have had to, and all youth have had to raise the money. All kids have had to raise the money. It's 25 cents a meal. We also help rescue women out of human trafficking and create backpacks that have their personal things that they need when they get rescued. And they share the love of Jesus with other people, and they feed people they don't even know, because it's a simple act of compassion. Because in every community there's hunger, in every community there's trafficking. And now kids are finding other, now our action teams are actually finding other areas that there is poverty and what is the pain that poverty causes, and they're creating their own ideas. It's very, very amazing. And I had a kid come up to me and say, why does this feel so good? And I said, are you asking me the question? Because if you ask me the question, I'm in a public school. So I said, if you ask me the question, I can give it to you. So you asking me why you feel so good? They said, yeah, why does it feel so good to do this? I said, because that's the love of Jesus. And the kid looked at me, right? And I said, it's unconditional love. And we're all built for it, and we're all born with it. We just have to find it. So my loneliness came from the fact that I didn't know who I was and I didn't know why I was doing what I was doing. And I got very lonely in an area that most people would think you were not lonely. And it took a young girl on the street to be able to change my thought process, and God put her there. And for the rest of my career, I was not lonely. I was very fulfilled. Three rings to prove it, just saying. But I'm messing with you. That's right. messing with you. I got an extra 2 minutes, so I thought I'd make a joke. So I just wanted to tell you, I said, I've been very fulfilled in what I did, and I know why I played, and I had my why. And I know who I am, and I know what I played for, and I still do it to this day. And I love sharing the love of Jesus through acts of compassion. And that's how I found who I was. And I got to tell my dad at 12 years old, one day I'm gonna be, and I got to accomplish that. And when I retired, my dad was on the field on my retirement speech, and I hugged my dad, and I said, Dad, you gave me the chance to say one day I'm gonna be, and I'm hugging you because I got to tell you that I'm happy that I became it, and I'm a better man for it, and I've got more to do. It was because of the platform that you gave me by encouraging me, and I found my place in Jesus and my identity in Christ, and now I can give to others and love other people. God bless you. Thank you for letting me hear you.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Jeremy, I'm not even that mad about the 2012 NLDS anymore. Thank you so much. Unbelievable. Hey, hope God sparked something in you today. If he did, share it. Share it. Every talk that you saw today, including this service in its entirety, will be on YouTube. Just search for Crossroads Church, or you can find it on our website, crossroads.net, or in our app, available free on the Apple Store or Google Play. We'll see you next week. Have a fantastic week.